Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace.
I'm Jaden.
This is Manny.
And my name's Ray.
Welcome. Welcome, Ray. Ray has a creator-owned project we're going to be talking about in a little bit. It's going to be the spotlight of this episode. So we want to thank him for joining us. And first, a couple bits of comic news.
We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
So with the DC Rebirth plans, some people have been wondering what's going to happen with some of these other titles, Poison Ivy in particular. There was an article on Bleeding Cool recently. Amy Chu was asking for her fans to speak up to DC about Poison Ivy to be sure there's going to be a collected edition for the trade that's going on right now, with her words and a Clayman art. And also, perhaps, because of the critical reception of the book, perhaps we could see an ongoing Poison Ivy or another miniseries going forward. The book has been almost kind of a surprise hit in a way, in as much as there's been fans and readers who want the book, but retailers kind of got caught unawares and didn't necessarily order in high enough numbers, let's say. And it's left some fans having a hard time finding the book in print. Of course, it's available digitally on Comixology, so... if you are interested, if you're one of those fans in Poison Ivy, make sure you're letting your retailers know so they can pre-order the books for you. And certainly reach out to DC on social media and let them know that you want more Poison Ivy. So have any of you guys been... I haven't checked it out, even though I'm a big Clayman fan. It's not that it's flown below my radar. It's just I've been so busy. I haven't had a chance to check it out, although I did buy the first issue.
No, I haven't personally really thought about picking it up. I'm not a big Poison Ivy fan. I do like Clayman, but I've never really been a big fan of the character Poison Ivy.
What about you, Manny, being such a Batman fan? Any interest?
Actually, I solicited the series from the beginning. I like Clayman's art. And then also, just the way that Poison Ivy has been characterized lately, especially in like Harley Quinn, where you see more of her... of her good, I guess, quote unquote good side, or her side she shows to, you know, loved ones. I thought it might be interesting. Plus, the artwork on the cover looked really good. And, yes. So surprise. It's a really good title.
Yeah, the first two issues are out so far. Have you actually read them?
Yeah, actually, today, because of my busy schedule, this is the first time, I think, in 3 weeks, yesterday, that I was able to pick up my books. And then it was the third issue. So I'm about 3/4 of the way through the third issue, and I really enjoy it because there's a lot of moments where she's really trying to, quote unquote, as she says, turn over a new leaf. And but unfortunately, at the lab she's working at, somebody got murdered, which happens right in the beginning. So I'm not giving away any spoilers. So she's thrown into the mix of trying to figure out who killed the scientist she's working with. And then she has a couple of moments throughout the book, so the series so far, where she kind of has to make decisions on going back to her old ways or really struggling to do the right thing. But at the same time, she has her own agenda in the background, which, of course, being that she's Poison Ivy, or in this case, Pamela Isley, she doesn't see it as a bad thing. She just sees it as she's trying to help the environment and help plants. But yeah, I mean, what we always say, if you really want a book or you really think something's going to be good, solicit it. That's the only way publishers are really going to know what's working, what's not. You ask for it, they will give it to you.
Is the Clayman art just as good as his work on Ninjak?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, I really like it.
Yeah, cool. All right, next bit of news, Gerard Way, who some of you may know as the lead singer for My Chemical Romance, he's a huge comic fan, and DC has tapped him to kind of be the showrunner for their Vertigo titles going forward. DC kind of tried to revitalize their Vertigo line toward the end of last year, the beginning of this year, launching a lot of new titles. The imprint, honestly, has been kind of floundering a bit since Karen Berger left. She was kind of the driving force of the imprint there at DC. But since she left and parted ways, they haven't really had those kind of runaway hits. So they tried to do a different kind of thing. It didn't really seem to work. Although I've tried some of the titles myself and I felt they were worth reading, they didn't really have a lot of buzz around the industry. So Gerard Way at one point was supposed to do a Deadpool comic, but and he's the first one to admit this, just based on him not being able to get the work done in a timely fashion because of his commitments as a singer in his band, basically, that kind of fell apart. So I don't know how much it's going to be him running the show, how much of it's just more like kind of like a PR publicity thing. What we do know is he has a huge following on social media. Like, I think the guy has like more than 1 million followers on Twitter, and a lot of his followers are devoted followers and you know, believe in the guy's creativity and such. So if DC can, and their Vertigo line can tap into some of that, this could be a win-win. So there's supposed to be an announcement at Emerald City Comic Con, which is going to be held next weekend. April, what would it be? The 8th, 9th, and 10th, I think, in Seattle. So we'll look for more news coming out of that. Next bit of news, Steve Rogers is young again in Captain America, Sam Wilson, number 7. And we knew this was coming down the pike. Steve Rogers was basically stripped of the super soldier serum, and so he kind of aged to his normal age, which would have been, you know, well into his 90s. Still very healthy and vital considering, but certainly not up to the task of being Captain America. And that's when he kind of passed the mantle to Sam Wilson. So it was announced a few months ago, Nick Spencer was going to be writing a Steve Rogers Captain America title. We knew Steve Rogers was going to be young again. Didn't necessarily know how that was going to happen, but we all knew that it was going to happen. You know, this year is Captain America's 75th anniversary, so we knew that he was going to return to the costume and be more of the Captain America that we expect him and the Steve Rogers we expect him to be, which is a young, vital, you know, super heroic guy. So I'm not going to spoil it for you. If you go to the article that's linked in the show notes from Bleeding Cool, it kind of explains exactly how that happens in Captain America, Sam Wilson, number 7. So, as I said, it's not really a surprise to anybody. It's kind of interesting the way they did it. I don't know that I'm going to pick up the new Captain America series. It just seems kind of redundant to me at this point. I just don't know where they can really take the character. And being that they have two Captain Americas and they're going to be on different sides in the upcoming Civil War, I don't know. It just, the idea just seems a little tired and played out to me, but I may pick up the first issue just to check it out. Nick Spencer is a writer whose work I enjoy, so maybe he'll bring something new there that I haven't necessarily been expecting. Any of you guys have any thoughts on this?
I thought it was pretty cool with the way that they did it. I'm not going to spoil it or anything, but it doesn't seem like a way that they've brought people like younger, like thousands of times before. It seems kind of unique.
Yeah, at least it's not a clone, right?
Yeah.
Manny, any thoughts?
No, not going to do it. Not going to buy another Marvel number 1.
All right, fair enough. Ray, have anything to add?
I always joke with my friend Ben back in the day. I would always pitch him a Captain America story, and I'd always be like, all right, this one's got two Captain Americas. See, one all then. Seems that's coming true. So, kind of interesting.
Yeah, and the last bit of comic news we have, Marvel has slowly been releasing these images for their Dead No More storyline. It's going to play out in their Spider-Man books starting up pretty soon. But I believe the first chapter is going to be on Free Comic Book Day. And so the first image we saw was a bunch of these supporting characters kind of emerging from the background. Characters like Jean DeWolf, Uncle Ben, just a sort of minor second tier characters. And it was kind of, there was kind of speculation, okay, who's it going to be? And then as more of the image has been revealed, we've seen characters like Dr. Octopus, Gwen Stacy. So there's a lot of speculation on who it might be coming back from the dead. And I guess we'll find out on Free Comic Book Day. That's supposedly when the secret's going to be released. So I kind of personally expect it to be Dr. Octopus, being that he's kind of, even though he's dead, well, he's not really dead. He's just, he has no body. Recently, we learned his consciousness is kind of in this robot. And so being that he's already been in the book to some extent, I kind of expect it to be him, but I guess we'll see. Any thoughts on this by you guys? Any Spider-Man love out there?
I've been hearing about this in a couple different places, and it sounds kind of interesting. I don't know. I feel like it also might just be a way for them to get money and capitalize on, like, hey, look, Uncle Ben's back and such is back. But I guess it's another way to bring back some villains in the Spider-Man universe that have died and they don't want to have to, like, reboot, I guess.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, they could have brought back anybody they wanted when they had the universe put back together after Secret Wars, but I guess we'll see.
The press has to do the right thing. You don't get to decide what the right thing is. Nobody cares about Clark Kent taking on the Batman.
And of course, Batman versus Superman is still dominating comic movie news right now, but not necessarily in a good way. The news came out today that there was a huge drop for Batman versus Superman over last weekend, like a 68% drop. You know, I kind of take this as a grain of salt. Last weekend was a holiday weekend. It was the opening weekend for Batman versus Superman. So, of course, it was going to have huge numbers. It couldn't possibly repeat those numbers. When you look at something like Star Wars, you know, it was kind of released over Christmas holiday. A lot of people were off work. Maybe you wouldn't see the same kind of attrition with ticket sales that you would for something like this when it's released on a holiday weekend. And then the following weekend, people are back at work. They're back into more of their own kind of routine. And honestly, the reviews have been so mixed that had to contribute as well. But I mean, it still came in number one. So I don't know how big of a news story this is. I still think Warner Brothers is considering it a big success. So you have thoughts on this, Manny?
I was going to comment the same thing you just said. I mean, it's tough right now because I've wanted to go see it again. I just don't have the time to really spend. I mean, if you think about it, between watching the movie and getting there, whatever, you're going to need about three and a half hours, maybe, because it's a 2.5 hour movie. That's a huge chunk of time to devote to a movie that you've already seen, especially if you had mixed feelings about it or if you're not a big fan. But I don't think it's a problem because, I mean, it broke so many good records over last weekend. And during the week, it had very good viewings also. So, you know what? It is what it is. But, of course, they're going to have to report it as a huge drop in ticket sales.
What about you, Jaden? Any thoughts?
Well, I mean, this is... I don't think that this is as big a news as they're making it out to be, but it is pretty crazy. 68% is a lot. Most movies expect a 50% drop, and that's like pretty average, and 68% is like 20% more than that. So I don't know. I think it's probably to do with the reviews, the people that saw it last weekend, or the people that were going to see it no matter what. But there's probably people that are on the fence. Maybe I'm going to see it, maybe I'm not. And the reviews were like, I guess I'll wait until it comes out on DVD.
Yeah, I think it's more, maybe we could consider it a bigger problem if it continues to see this kind of attrition. But if it's just this one big drop and then it kind of stays level for a while, you know, it could end up kind of evening out over time. So I guess we'll see. Now, Ray, you said you actually went and saw it recently.
Yeah, I saw it on Monday as a way to unwind from WonderCon, and I thought it was okay. I had mixed feelings about it. But it does seem to me that it's almost like there's kind of a lot of demand to write bad things about it in terms of this, like, you know, I feel like it's still the number one movie, right? And yeah. it's just the press feels very hypersensitive to want to portray as not a success. At least that's what it feels like for me.
Was it crowded when you went? Did you go Monday night or during the day?
I went Monday night, and it was, I would say the theater was about a third crowded or a third full, so not crowded at all, really.
Yeah. All right. Interesting. Next bit of news, Benedict Cumberbatch as Doctor Strange in the latest set photos from some New York filming, and they've actually wrapped with the filming. I saw the pictures, and okay, let's take this with a grain of salt. This is a grown man dressed in a colorful superhero comic book costume, so when it's not seen at the right angle, you know, when it's not there, you know, in the movie, polished up, post-production added to it and everything to make it look cool, it's, you know, it's a grown man dressed in this funny, colorful looking costume. That being said, I thought he looked awesome. He looked every bit like what I would expect Doctor Strange to look like in real life. And yeah, I I wasn't necessarily sure when he was announced as Doctor Strange if it was the best choice, but you know, I usually try to keep an open mind about these things because ever since I disagreed vehemently with Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, and then you know saw how wrong I was, ever since then I've been sure to keep an open mind about these things. And yeah, he looks great. You know, I don't know that the movie's going to be any good. It doesn't necessarily mean just because he looks like what I imagine Doctor Strange would look like in the real world that the movie's going to be any good. But, you know, I'll keep an open mind about that as well. But I thought he looked great. What did you think, Jaden?
I loved Benedict Cumberbatch. When I heard that he was going to be cast in this movie, I was like, now I have to see Doctor Strange. Because before, I don't think I probably would have seen it, but I wouldn't have went and saw it in theaters. But, like, this is pretty much what I expected him to look like. He looks really good. I don't know. I'm pretty excited about it. In my opinion, there hasn't been a bad Marvel movie. There have been worse ones, but I don't think there's been a bad one yet.
Manny?
I really have no interest in Doctor Strange. I don't know much about the character, and although I like the actor, I did think he looked kind of funny. But yeah, you're right. These are shots by people on set, so nothing like what it's going to be in the end. So, then again, I could be proven wrong. I made fun of Ant-Man for so long, and that's like the only character I can stand in the Marvel Universe right now. So I guess it's a wait and see, but not a lot of interest.
Ray, you a big Doctor Strange fan?
Not too big, but I think they got the casting spot on. I mean, he looks good. He looks like Doctor Strange, so that's pretty cool.
Right on. Our last bit of movie news, Deadpool has continued to bring in money. You know, it's continued to do well. It certainly doesn't have the kind of attrition that we were just talking about for Batman versus Superman as far as ticket sales. And in fact, it has now become the highest grossing X-Men movie ever. So, you know, a big win for Ryan Reynolds, a big win for everybody involved with that movie. We talked about this several times on the podcast. I just hope that the powers that be that make these comic book movies don't do what Hollywood has a tendency to do, and that's just copycat and parrot the way a certain movie has done things and become a huge success, because the things they did with Deadpool worked because it was Deadpool. You know, just like that article James Gunn wrote after the success of Deadpool's opening weekend, it doesn't mean you can do it with every comic book movie. It doesn't mean that every comic book movie needs to have humor. It doesn't mean every comic movie needs to be rated R. So I just hope that Hollywood doesn't do what they always do and become a bunch of copycats, and everybody's trying to make Deadpool version of this and Deadpool version of that, because it could ruin what otherwise might be some good movies. And I saw some talk about this week also, because Warner Brothers was doing some reshoots for Suicide Squad. And I heard people saying, oh, look what happened with the most recent Fantastic Four when they did a lot of reshoots. That movie was horrible. You know what? I think that Fantastic Four movie was horrible before the reshoots, and it was certainly horrible after the reshoots. I don't think that necessarily had anything to do with it. But, you know, there was the talk of them doing reshoots for Suicide Squad to add a little more humor. I feel like that has more to do with the reception of the last trailer that was released that had a bit more of the humor. And I just think with the direction that the new Suicide Squad DC Rebirth comic is going to take, they wanted to inject a little more humor. So I feel like they did that for the sake of that movie, not necessarily because they were going to try to copy Deadpool, which is what a lot of people online were speculating. So I hope that Suicide Squad is still good. I'm still excited to see it. But yeah, Deadpool, highest grossing X-Men film ever. I only saw it once. Did you go see it more than once, Manny?
No, I just saw it once. It was enough because, you know, although some movies are really good, you know, jokes get played out after a while. So something that I'll wait to see again and just enjoy at a later time.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, as far as you're talking about the Suicide Squad reshoots, it's funny. You can't really please people because you leave it how it is. Oh, it's going to be too dark, too grimy. But then, you know, they hear the outpouring cry of we want, you know, something lighter, and it's like, well, let's take some time, let's spend some money and give people what they want, and all of a sudden it's, oh, look, they're reshooting, they're trying to copy people. It's like, really? You know what? Shut up, because at the end of the day, they're trying their best. I mean, they're not trying to sabotage the film. They're not trying to make a bad film. They're trying to make a good quality film to make some money. So it's not easy to do, especially with the storyline like Suicide Squad has, where you have so many different personalities. Even within the characters, they have different personalities with them. And the fact that they listened to what the outcry was, I think was great. But now I kind of want to see what they had before the reshoots, which I hope they probably release with the DVD, Blu-ray, whatever.
No, definitely. I mean, right now, when it comes to, you know, with them being able to work out the whole mess with, well, it wasn't really a mess. It was just, it took a little bit longer, I think, than they wanted to. CBS and CW doing crossover, that worked out really well. And then just with what they're doing with Rebirth, we saw over the past weekend at WonderCon, the return of Nightwing in his blue outfit. And also, I mean, you got a star-studded all-star Batman, and then a great writer in Tom King on regular Batman. Not to mention, you brought back things like Birds of Prey. You have Blue Beetle. I mean, just great stuff. It seems like they really took a step back and are listening to what people want, what fans want, what comic book readers want, and they're making it happen on all platforms. Even for Justice League, they've already the writer has come out, one of the writers come out and said this movie is going to be a whole lot lighter than Batman v Superman. So and I mean just also with on Batman vs Superman, they listened to some aspects. One quick example: most of the fight scenes and where they're brawling and stuff, whether it was Doomsday or Superman and Batman, happened in areas that were where there weren't any people. Either it was an abandoned factory or an abandoned island off of Gotham, or even where on Luthor's Doomsday, it was an area where, an industrial area where people had already gone home. So they wanted to make sure that people watching the movies knew the death toll is going to be minimal this time. We know. So, like I said, they're listening, and it looks like they're making changes, and I really like that in what they're doing.
You have any thoughts on this, Jaden? Deadpool being the
highest? No, not really. I mean, the Deadpool thing doesn't surprise me at all. I think it reaches the most audience as well with X-Men. Like, I don't think regular X-Men movies really reach as broad of an audience as Deadpool does. I bet I can bring a lot of different people to Deadpool that aren't necessarily comic fans, and they would enjoy it.
What are you gonna do?
Whatever it takes.
So we have the Iron Fist show coming up on Netflix. It's our one TV news item. They've cast their Colleen Wing, Jessica Henwick. Supposedly she was in Star Wars The Force Awakens. I don't know what role. I'm not familiar with her at all. I haven't watched any Netflix Marvel shows. But yeah, they have their Colleen Wing. So are you pretty excited for Iron Fist, Jaden?
I am, but there's not really much out there about it yet. So,
what about you,
but Manny? Everything they put out so far has been really good.
What about you, Manny?
I don't really know much about the character, so just kind of like Jessica Jones, I'm going to kind of go into it a little, I guess, blindsided or much, and I would never really. Yeah, I don't even know what his powers are.
Fair enough.
Welcome.
We'll say welcome once again to Ray Chow. So Ray's here to talk about Skies of Fire. So for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with it, I came across Ray walking through Artist Alley at WonderCon, and I kind of did a double take as I walked past his booth just because the artwork really, it caught my eye. It looked like something new, something different. So Ray, why don't you give our listeners an overview of what Skies of Fire entails?
Yeah, sure. So Skies of Fire is an original comic series written by myself and my partner Vincenzo Fierro, who's based out of London, and with art by Pablo Pepino and Brian Valenza. And it is a dieselpunk airship story of loyalty and revenge. That's kind of the one go-to one-liner that I always use. So it's essentially about a captain who has to assemble a crew to chase down a pirate through this storm called the Expanse. And so it's about her figuring out how to recruit these people and how to go after this pirate and what happens when she actually does. And we've been working on it for the past 2 years now. And we release a new issue about every 10 months or so. And we're completely self-published, so we do everything ourselves. We pay all of our artists, and we're able to do that through the power of Kickstarter. And we have kind of an interesting distribution model with that. But that's essentially Skies of Fire in a nutshell.
Yeah. Now, and first of all, thanks for joining us to talk about this this incredible book, and also for hooking me up with some digital copies so I could share it with Jaden and Manny, because they didn't have the physical copies that I picked up at WonderCon. And Jaden, Manny, you guys, I mean, I'm glad you got to read it, because this book is definitely worth reading, in my opinion. But you could, reading it digitally, you kind of missed out on the unique format that it has. I mean, it's larger than a regular size comic. Production values are incredibly high. So, and it's really cool that it's this larger size with these beautiful colors, because it really helps the artwork shine. And also, there's no ads, which is also really, really cool. And so the format of the book, you know, it's high quality paper. You know, it really feels like you're getting something for your money, something of value. So next time I see you guys, I'll have to be sure and show you the actual physical copies of the book. Ray, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the origin of the idea. How did you and Vinny come up with this idea of this kind of steampunk world where zeppelins, or dirigibles, if you will, are kind of the main mode of transportation?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for having us, for having me. I mean, this is our first podcast, so it's really exciting. It's great to talk to people about the project, and yeah. So thanks for having us. In terms of the idea for the story, so me and Vinny went to film school together. Oh, that's great. I'm gonna call him Vinny from now on too. He's gonna hate that. But so we went to film school circa 2009, 2010, and Vince has always been like super, super enthusiastic, and always was the type of guy who wanted to tell you his ideas and wanted to tell you like all the crazy things that he had cooking in his brain. And first and foremost among those ideas was this idea of a Zeppelin movie. So whenever we were on set, whenever we were in classes, anytime he had a free moment, he would always go, guys, let me tell you about my Zeppelin movie. Let me tell you about my airship movie. Let me tell you about my airship movie. And he would just not shut up about this. And if you ask anybody from our year, they've all heard the airship story. And they're all like, wow, he's actually doing it now. So, Vince moved, when we graduated, Vince moved to Italy first and then London, because he's actually an Italian citizen. So, you know, he couldn't stay because of visa stuff. And I moved back to Los Angeles, but we kept in touch and we remained writing partners. And so he would send me material, and, you know, I would give him like good feedback on it, and I would send him material and vice versa. And we came up with a couple of other ideas here, like a reality TV show and whatnot. But eventually he sent me his first draft of Skies of Fire, and I was like, holy crap, Vince, you actually did it. And I read it, and I was like, this is great. I think you should, you know, I had some suggestions for him, and he was really receptive to them. And I asked him if I could take a pass on it, basically, and he was like, yeah, sure, man. So I took a pass at it. He liked a lot of the changes, and then he kind of wrote on top of what I had suggested as changes, and we went back and forth like that for about 2 to 3 months, until we had like what we thought was a very solid 127 page screenplay. And after we completed that screenplay, we were like, well, this is great. We don't know anybody. This movie is never going to get made, you know, like we're never going to sell this $200-300 million movie. So what do we do with it now? And I just kind of looked at him, and I was like, well, let's just turn it into a comic book. Let's try and make it as real as possible within our means to do so. And, you know, comic books are a visual medium too, and we can kind of, we'll be able to sort of adapt it for that. And he thought that was a great idea. So then we basically went about the, like a quest to learn how to make comic books, basically. And so, you know, we looked up all the stuff and we kind of saw like what was out there. Eventually we decided that we needed to pay our artists. We needed to give them a fair page rate, because that was the only way that they would take us seriously, is if we sort of took them seriously. So we went on DeviantArt and digital webbing and whatnot, and we posted job postings for an artist, and we set up a pretty high page rate, and we said, okay, we're looking for 5 pages right now, here's the one liner. And we got about 200 or so portfolios, and we just sort of went through every single one. We found the top 10 that we thought were like the would be best for the project. We narrowed that down to a top 5. And with those top 5, we commissioned them for $50 worth of artwork. We didn't tell them how much artwork to send us, but we did send them sort of the overall concept, and as well as the first 10 pages of the script. And we sort of went, okay, just go with it. Just, and show us what you would do. And that allowed us to see sort of the different styles and if they meshed with our ideas. And, you know, some people turned in a lot of material, some people turned in less material. So it kind of gave us an idea of what it would be like to work with the artists as well. And then eventually we found Pablo, who was the first guy we contacted. He was the most enthusiastic right off the bat. He sent a sketch within 2 hours, and the sketch was just a really simple sketch of an airship blowing up in the sky. But immediately you could tell, like, okay, this guy is working in the same wheelhouse that we're working at, and he's got the sort of the same idea. And the other artists were all really, really talented too, but some of them would have stuff like, you know, they would have wooden airships, or it would be more in a sci-fi direction. But with Pablo, he kind of already got the look and feel that we were going for right away.
So that's an interesting way to find collaborators. And another one of the things I find interesting about your project is the collab. You guys are all worldwide. I mean, nobody seems to be close to each other. I mean, you know, Vince is in London, you're in LA, Pablo's in Argentina, is that right?
Yeah, well, he was in Argentina for the first issue, but he subsequently moved to Valencia, Spain, so he's living in Spain now.
Okay, so everybody's spread out. It's like a worldwide project, right? I mean, how did you find the other collaborators? Was it much in the same vein, just kind of searching on the internet and finding people that had the same sensibility?
Yeah, that's basically how it happened. We had good success with that first experience with Pablo, so we were like, okay, let's just do the same thing with everybody else. So we literally just went on DeviantArt, posted one for a colorist, did the same thing, got a bunch of samples, got a bunch of really, really good talented colorists, and you know, gave them like $30 each, I think, for a sample concept art, just like coloring one of Pablo's like samples, basically. And then we chose, we found Brian off of that, and he was really excited, and then he just did an amazing job on the sequentials. And then with the lettering aspect, at first we didn't really consider like lettering to be that important. It was kind of like a rookie mistake. We were like, oh yeah, you know, letters, just put words on the page. But no, it's actually like one of the most important things, because it really kind of separates like what a professional book looks like and what sort of just other books look like, basically. So we found someone at first, but it just didn't look the way we wanted to. So we were like, okay, we should take this seriously. And we saw a bunch of different people, but Nick was far and away, like, he was like the best letterer that we found. So it wasn't sort of like, it's not like we said, okay, we need a worldwide, we need a global perspective or whatnot for this project, but that's just sort of how it ended up. And I think maybe because of the way we envisioned it as well, and the way our influences as well, that maybe had something to do with our choices.
Yeah, and I think the book is richer for it, being that it's a new world to explore. And so you're bringing these different sensibilities by having these collaborators that are international. And just to speak to letters, yeah, lettering is one of those things that's often overlooked, and nobody notices when it's done really well, and nobody usually compliments it. But when it's done poorly and it's done wrong, it's one of the first things you notice. It pulls you out of the story, and everyone's the first one to jump on and say, oh man, that's horrible.
Oh yeah, totally, totally. And we learned that lesson the hard way. But I mean, I'm glad we learned it early on.
Yeah, so definitely Nick's work, you know, he's kind of the unsung hero. And I, one thing I like about the book, it's very unique in that it uses rectangular balloons for the words. So that's really cool.
Yeah, we actually took that directly from The Adventures of Tintin. That was Vince's idea. He was like, I want the book to sort of look and feel and kind of evoke Tintin. And he was like, can we do the dialogue bubbles in that kind of rectangular style? And yeah, that's a great idea. So we kind of rolled with that. And I think it helps make our book stand out a little bit.
Yeah, it gives it kind of a little bit of a nostalgic feel, much like Tintin has, like you mentioned. How did you find the Kickstarter experience doing that for the first time? That had to be a pretty steep learning curve as well.
Yeah, so once we found the artist, we were kind of not sure of how else to proceed. Like, we thought, okay, maybe we should just pursue a traditional, you know, do some image submissions, submit to Dark Horse or whatnot. And I mean, we didn't know anybody. We were just literally looking up on the internet, figuring out how other people tried to break into the industry. But the more that we sort of looked at the state of the current comic industry, the more we realized that, you know, Kickstarter is this kind of, at the time, was kind of like, I guess it still is, but it was kind of this up and coming thing. And it seemed like a lot of indie comics were getting their start from Kickstarter, and there was a lot of sort of buzz about it. And the more research we did, the more it sort of made sense. It was like, okay, if say we do go to submit to a publisher and none of them say anything or just reject us, what then, right? But if we do the Kickstarter, we at least have the first book done or have the means to do the first book. And doesn't that just put us in a better position? Can't we just still go to publishers after that? So why wouldn't we just do that? So that's sort of how we settled on doing a Kickstarter. And yeah, it was quite a big learning curve. I think the process of making a comic book in general was like a crazy learning curve, but it's kind of neat because, that's one of the things I really love about working on comics and working on Skies of Fire, is that I've learned so much through it, just not only from a storytelling and comic book medium standpoint, but from sort of a business standpoint as well. So, you know, I did a lot of research, ahead of time. I looked up at a lot of Kickstarters. I backed a lot of Kickstarters as well, and just sort of dissected, like, okay, what is the business model of Kickstarter for these comics, and what are they asking for, and how do they get it, basically? So, you know, I kind of relayed the information back to Vince and eventually came up with a plan. And in our initial Kickstarter, we actually didn't want to do a print run whatsoever. But it just sort of happened because we reached a point. So our initial plan was, we were like, okay, Comixology, we'll submit on Comixology to submit, and that'll be our main distribution platform, and that's how we're going to find our audience or whatnot. And then for people who do want copies, yeah, we'll order them copies, but we'll do it through an on-demand printer. So we'll just print however many that people wanted. We reached a point in that first Kickstarter where about 200 to 300 people wanted copies of the physical book. And that, in terms of the economics of like the business side of the comics, that's about the same price if you go to like a digital printer. If you print 300 books, it's almost the same price as if you printed 1,000 books offset. And the only difference is really the time it takes to ship from overseas, basically. So seeing that, we were like, okay, well, it makes more sense for us to print 1,000. And once we have 1,000, I guess that makes us a publisher. And I guess we have to sell these books. But I'm really glad it happened, because from that point on, we kind of learned about doing the whole small press, like self-publishing aspect. And I think the book is really best experienced as a print copy. Like, digital is great, but there's something about the size of the book. And speaking to the unique size, that's actually something that happened because of Kickstarter as well. We originally were going to plan to do it as a normal, like a standard comic book size, but that was one of the first stretch goals that we set. We were like, okay, we'll make it magazine size 8x11. And actually, that was a at the time, we thought it was a huge mistake, because after I had announced it, I went to my local comic book store, Comics Factory out in Pasadena, and I was just looking at the stuff on their shelf, and I asked the owner, I was like, do you guys have anything that's like in magazine format or oversized? And he kind of looked at me and he was like, we don't really like carrying that kind of stuff because it messes with our inventory system. So that was quite scary, and we thought we made a huge like sort of business blunder. But luckily, people seem to really respond to that large format, so it ended up kind of working out for us.
Yeah, you know, there used to be a lot of that size. You know, Marvel and DC both, back in the 70s especially, used to do a lot of that size with black and white stories, horror stories. But yeah, it kind of faded away as the direct market kind of took hold and
right.
People wanted more of a, you know, to just be able to buy one size of bag and one side of board. You know, that's more of like the collector mentality. But, you know, from a reader standpoint, from someone who wants to enjoy the book, you know, the bigger the better. So I think it's awesome. I mean, the production value on it is just like I was walking by your booth. I saw the artwork. I said, oh, that looks interesting. And check it out. Let's pick up the first three books. And then when you actually pulled them out and I was like, oh, they're magazine size. Sweet. Like, yeah, I was really, really excited to see that. So, yeah, much like you said, a very fortuitous turn of events there.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk about how long it took to actually put the book together. So once you had reached your, you know, goal and you're ready to get the book, how long did it take from the time you said, okay, we successfully kickstarted the book. Let's go into production. Let's get everything together until it was actually like, in the hands of your backers. How long, what was the time frame there?
Right. So, this is kind of a cool story too. So at first I think our deadline was, July or August or something. We set a summer deadline. And we did it because, we sort of said like, great. So we have this, we have the money to make this book now. Like, what do we do afterwards? And so we were like, well, let's go to San Diego Comic-Con and like, let's get a booth and like, let's sell it. And, you know, not knowing anything about sort of conventions at the time, you know, I sort of went on the website and I was like, this was in March or April at the time. And I was like, how do I get a booth at San Diego Comic-Con this year? And they very politely informed me, you know, like it's a little bit late in the application process. And actually, because San Diego is in such high demand that there's actually a 3-year wait list to get a booth there, yeah. Which has since changed. The small press is now, I think as of this year, an application process. So it's kind of merit based now. So we're going this year. But in any case, that happened and we were like, okay, so I guess we're not doing July. Let's go to New York Comic Con instead. Cause you know, it's the second biggest, and New York is a good location because it's in between LA and London, basically smack dab in the middle. So we'll both be able to meet. And plus we went to New York for school and we have a bunch of friends out there. We'll be able to crash at someone's place. So we pay for the booth for New York Comic Con in the summertime. And then our deadline for our Kickstarter kind of came and went as that sort of happened. And we thought we were still okay though. We were like, okay, as long as we hit the sort of New York Comic Con deadline, will be okay. So originally we were going to go with a printer from China, an offset printer, and we thought we had planned out the timeline really well. And we were like, okay, as long as we finish by sort of like August, a certain date in August, we'll be okay. We'll be able to print the books. We'll be able to get them. We'll be okay for New York Comic Con. But then one day in September, I went on the printer's website and they were like, due to China's Golden Week, which is basically their labor holiday, but it's a week long labor holiday. So due to this holiday, all shipments will be delayed in turnaround by up to 4 weeks. And at that point, I turned really pale and my heart sunk. And I was like, that's not going to work. We're not going to get the book done in time. Like we're not going to be able to get them. So I had to sort of call around at the last minute and figure out how to print the books in time for New York Comic Con. And the sort of saving grace, what that forced us to do really was to learn a lot about printing in a really short amount of time and learn about all the terms and stuff that you need to sort of talk to printers. And we were able to find sort of just a local mass printer that was able to do it for not as cheap as it would be overseas, but cheap enough where we could, you know, we would still be okay. And more importantly, like the turnaround time would be 1 week or something, as opposed to 6 to 8 weeks that it takes when you print a book in China. So literally on the week of New York Comic Con 2014, I got the books on a Monday. I flew out on a Tuesday and the show was on Thursday, and that was our debut. And it was that close.
Wow.
We almost did not have anything to show and almost just kind of blew it entirely. But yeah, deadlines, I guess in anything, but especially for creative stuff, deadlines are really important. You know, they really push kind of everybody in the team to really crunch and double down and make sure you get stuff done.
Yeah, that's I've heard that from a lot of creators. So just because you're small press, don't think that it changes when you hit the big time. I hear that from,
yeah.
I hear that from everybody from Jim Lee to Scott Snyder to Dan Slott. So how was the reception? Was it everything you hoped it would be at New York when debuting the book?
Oh yeah, it was great. It was amazing that first, because it was our first real con. You know, we didn't really quite know what we were doing when we were just so enthusiastic and like selling the book, and not saying that we're not enthusiastic when we go to cons now, but there's just something about that first time. And I had not seen Vince in person in like, I don't know, four years, I think, since college, basically. And Pablo was with us too, and we just had our whole little crew, and we were selling the book, and everybody seemed to really like that first issue. Some of our backers came, and we were able to talk to them, and we were just so incredibly grateful, and it was just an amazing experience.
Cool. Let's talk a little bit about the story itself. Maybe you could talk about the design of the world overall, and you know how did that came out about organically through deciding how to tell the story and kind of the setting, just kind of set the background for our listeners.
Yeah, so Vince and I are kind of publishing imprint. We call ourselves Mythopia, which comes from a Tolkien word that he made up and wrote a poem about that basically means to create myths or create entire worlds. And I think we call ourselves that because it kind of encompasses our philosophy on the projects that we do together. So growing up, Vince and I were always sort of like, I like to say that the reason why we bonded so well in college is because we both recognized that we were left alone quite a bit as children to kind of roam in our own imaginations. And so we both kind of like played sort of just on our own after school or in a lot of the afternoons. And I was really into Dungeons and Dragons, and I was always the DM, always the DM, and always into science fiction, fantasy, just always just geek culture in general. And Vince was the same way, but you know, with slightly different stuff. And so when we were designing the world, we knew we wanted a really rich history for the world. We wanted to go beyond just like telling this one story. So kind of the driving force behind what creating this world was the question of, okay, why are airships the dominant means of transport, commerce and war? Why would it be airships and not any other sort of system? So from there, we sort of designed certain elements of the world. We were like, okay, geographically, we want things to be sort of have rough terrain, not really easily navigatable. And then we sort of worked backwards, and we're both history buffs too. So we're like, okay, so if we had this invention and this was sort of the Industrial Revolution moment, this invention of the airship, like, what would that mean? Does that mean, what would the culture look like beforehand? A loose collection of city states. So how recent would they unite? And then just sort of working like that to flesh out all the details and, the world building stuff before we even get to the story, which is on the grand scale of things, like relatively small compared to the history of the world.
Why did you choose, is there a significance to the name Aquila, world, the main land or nation kingdom that we're talking about? Was there a particular reason you focused on that part, or was it that you created that first and then you kind of built the world around it?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of the latter, where this is like we sort of set like kind of the history and culture of this world, and we were like, all right, the expanse is here. What does that mean for these people, and like how? And this was sort of our just where we focused on the story at first, basically, and we kind of built the world outwards from this land, and so that's sort of like where we naturally focused our attention to first.
And was it that love of history that kind of set the stage as far as what kind of a kingdom it is? I mean, it seems a bit repressive to me, and seems from the characters we've seen, there's kind of a very tiered system of society. Did you kind of take that from your love of history and feel that it suited best for the story, or is there something else in the background there that explains that more so?
A little bit. The driving force behind sort of like the empire is, so we reason that this kingdom, the reason why this particular city kind of grew to dominate all the other cities in this area. First of all, Vince is Italian, and he loves Italian history, and he loves anything Italian. So a lot of sort of what he does is influenced by Italian history and has this sort of Italian feel to it. So he's done a lot of research into the past on some other projects with regards to Italian city-states and the Renaissance period. So I think that had a major influence when he was sort of designing the world initially. But our sort of reasoning behind the history of it is, all right, if this one particular city, Monterey, was the starting point, and they were able to use their technology, this invention of the airship, to just get a huge leg up in terms of trade, in terms of commerce, basically, where by the time the other sort of kingdom, city-states were trying to fight back economically, it was almost already too late. Like, they had already just gotten such a big head start, and they were already sort of creating this hegemony, I want to say, is that the right word? Within the continent, essentially. So it is a relatively recent kind of invention, this kingdom, within the past, I think, 200 years of our history. And there's also other stuff that influences sort of how they react to, like, there's a civil war that is, you know, kind of featured in issue 3 in the Copperheaded Records that recently happened, and there are some succeeding states that split away from it. So and that was only 50 years or so ago. So the culture is still very imperialistic, kind of militaristic, and sort of reeling from that discovery. And then, you know, within last 15, 20 years, they've had this piracy problem that is just kind of crippling the economy. So all these sort of factors, I think, came into play when we're designing, like, sort of the power structures at play in the world.
Okay, well, you can have the best setting, the most interesting setting to tell a story, but if the characters aren't engaging and relatable, then, you know, it doesn't really matter what the window dressing is, right? So there's got to be a huge difference between the way you get across characterization in something like a film, and you said you two, you know, both went to film school, versus a comic. And, you know, you wrote this originally as a movie, you know, script. And now you've transferred it over to a sequential storytelling in comic book form. So did you find the characterization and developing the characters, was it a challenge going through that change and coming at it through a different kind of storytelling standpoint?
I think so. I mean, we've learned a lot about sort of writing comic books and making comic books since that sort of first initial stage. And I think one of the big observations we've made in terms of the comic medium versus maybe the cinematic or the moving picture medium is that the way you compress space is really differently. And specifically, reactions are very, very difficult sometimes for comics, or they're not difficult, but they take up a lot of real estate. And, you know, how much real up on the page determines the pacing of your story. So the way we naturally write is we sort of have a lot of reaction shots, and reaction shots work really well in comics, but we realized that we had to be a little bit more judicious in our use of reaction shots, because if we were telling our artists to have reaction shots every other page or so, it's like, well, that's just going to fill up the page, and it's just going to make the book longer, but not necessarily deeper in terms of the story beats. So how like you compress and expand space within, with in between the frames was sort of like a bit of a learning curve. And I think we're getting slightly better with that. What's interesting too is we have a general outline of where the story is going and who these characters are, but every issue we write, we deviate a little bit more from it. So it's at this point, you know, we're completely off script of that original screenplay. I mean, it's completely different, basically. The large sort of overtones are there, but we're always changing stuff. And I think as time has progressed, we've gotten a little bit better about taking advantage of sort of the comic medium and being able to fill more story within certain panels, as opposed to having things a little bit elongated, which maybe it feels that way in like the first issue or so, or maybe even the second one. So that's sort of been a learning curve. And then subsequently, like writing in comics and with our other projects, yeah, we sort of write in native comic format too, and that changes the way that the story is paced as well. But the guiding principle for our artistic aesthetic is still, we want things to be cinematic. We want the art to sort of tell the story. We want to tell it really visually. We want there to be fewer panels, you know, between 5 to 6 panels on a page if possible. And that stuff we knew we wanted to do right away, and we sort of set guidelines for our artists with.
Yeah, it definitely has a cinematic feel. It's the storytelling from panel to panel is excellent. Something I always pay a lot of attention to as a longtime comic reader. And it's certainly for you listeners out there that don't like those wordy comics, this is not at all. I wouldn't say the dialogue is sparse, but it's there where it's needed, but the visuals tell the story, and it gives it that cinematic feel when needed. And as far as letting the story grow organically, I'm very glad to hear you say that, because it's something that I hear from a lot of veteran comic writers, and being that this is really your first comic project, it seems like that's a lesson you've learned early on. So I congratulate you on that. That's a lesson that sometimes takes a lot longer for comic writers to learn, that you don't need to be shackled to your original ideas and your original outlines.
Yeah, definitely.
As far as reaction shots, I'll just say that something I learned from David Schulner, who comes from the TV side of things and has written one of my favorite comic series ever, Clone, is that if you do something too often, it can lose its impact. So not only constant reaction shots would eat up real estate, but I feel it would lose impact as well if you're using that same, you know, story device over and over, where in a film you can frame it different ways perhaps, and it doesn't seem like it's coming across the page in the same, or coming across in the story the same way.
Definitely.
So Manny has some questions after having looked at the book. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Manny. What questions do you have for Ray?
Definitely a very engaging book, and I'm happy to say that I'm looking forward to the next book, number 4, whenever it's available. And but my question is regarding the expansion and the raiders themselves. I noticed that on the first issue, they make a quick getaway into the expansion, and then a little bit further ahead, you kind of learn a little bit more about it, that it's an area that at first it was thought to have religious properties, and then over the years, with the development of science and a little bit of research, there's some folks who are thinking that it has more of a natural cause to it. My question is, what makes these raiders so special, as well as their airships, that they're able to travel through this area, and while scientists and others who have devoted their lives to it cannot?
Yeah, so it's funny you to ask me that question, because we actually do answer that in issue 3, but we don't answer it directly, and it requires a bit of sort of digging into it. So I mean, that's all I can really say, but we do, this is something we've thought of, and it's kind of on our mind. But in terms of sort of like, we always try and reveal more or tell more of the world through kind of the supplementary material we have in the back. And we kind of, you know, kept that in mind with the design of all that stuff. But there is a specific reason, and it will be revealed in the actual sequential pages somewhere down the line. It is sort of an important plot point, but I can't really talk more about it without spoiling the story, basically.
No, that's great. I mean, if it's going to come, it's going to come. And to be honest with you, I'd rather figure it out that way, which actually, something you said brings me to my next point. Within reading comic books, I as a reader always love something I call goodies in the back that help out the story that I just read in the previous few pages. What's the thought process behind those extra pieces? Because I see that you have some like government letters. Also, you have some newspaper articles. You have one section. We have a kind of a wall of remembrance of people who have fallen. What's the thought process behind adding those pieces, and how do you make a decision?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm glad you really enjoy it, because it always like, for Vince and I, whenever someone says they enjoy kind of the supplementary material, that always puts the biggest smile on our face, because we really enjoy doing it. At first, it was actually sort of a stretch goal that we put in for our initial Kickstarter. We were like, okay, we'll add like kind of stuff from the world. And I think the idea was I loved growing up, I loved playing games like Warcraft 2 and like Starcraft, and having the manual and just always kind of reading through the manual. And then that kind of love translated to tabletop RPGs and just reading. I'm just such a big fluff nerd all the time, and always love reading that type of stuff where they're just kind of world building. So I asked Vince, basically, I was like, we have a lot of this stuff created already for the world itself. Why don't we just use the extra space that we'll have, and just be able to flesh out the world and sort of tell the story from a different perspective that's sort of related, that will kind of inform the readers who care to go that in depth. So that was the initial thought behind it. And in terms of the individual documents that you mentioned, so we kind of think about it every single time whenever we're doing an issue, like, okay, what would be really interesting? What's important that we need to show? With regards to the war memorial, like that document in the back of the first issue, that's actually our Kickstarter credit page. But we didn't want to do it just in the way of a regular sort of thanks to all these people. So we designed it as the Battle of Solitude Ridge, which is the biggest airship battle that this world has ever seen. So every one of our original backers was able to basically put whatever they wanted as their name for their kind of memorial, but their ranking is based off of how much they donated. So if you see a Commodore or a Captain there, that they like dished out some serious cheddar on Kickstarter. And if you see like a midshipman, it's like a medium amount, and then the cadet maybe gave like a dollar or two, basically.
That's a cool idea. No, I just said that's a really cool idea of a way to do it, rather than just thanks for contributing. They're actually in a way part of the world.
Yeah, we murdered them as a thanks for supporting us, basically.
Well, no, it's way better than just thank you for your support. It kind of like Jace just said, makes you part of that world. My last question I wanted to ask is about Captain Pierce herself. I know there's some people who don't like doing issues where you go back and do kind of like a one-shot issue, but are you guys maybe thinking of somewhere down the line doing a little bit of her backstory?
We are. You hit it right on the nail. You totally read our minds. We are, and we've actually started. We started working on that just today, just within this past weekend, basically. So you are like, You're reading our minds, basically.
Nice.
So yeah, and we want to do it with Captain Pierce will be the first one, but we want to do a lot of the characters and have like kind of interesting little one shots, basically. That is sort of our concept at this point.
All right, Jaden, you had some questions for Ray as well.
My first question is, what other media or movies and any sort of things that really influenced you in like the story in this? Because it reminded me a lot of like a pirate story, but just like in the air, but like more complicated than that. Is there certain things that you've drawn on?
So in terms of the aesthetic, the cine, like the way that that Pablo lays it out, I know he and Vince are big spaghetti western fans, Sergio Leone fans. So that's sort of the guideline I feel like between the visual language of the comic, where there's a lot of sort of close-ups on the eyes and shots of the feet and stuff like that. In terms of the story influence, I think maybe like subconsciously we had like the blender full of pirate stories. I wouldn't say that there was one sort of like solid story where we went, okay, this is sort of a major influence on. It was really more like aesthetically, we talked about influences a lot. Like we wanted the colors to look Miyazaki-esque. We wanted really vibrant primary colors. We wanted the brightest blues, the sharpest reds, just pops of color everywhere. We wanted it to look really beautiful. The way that Miyazaki shows the sky was really important. Something that we really wanted to do. And then kind of Tintin for, you know, not just the thought bubbles, but in terms of kind of the color aesthetic as well, was a big influence. And then one that I sort of mentioned that I wanted to do was Brian Hitch. I wanted it to be really cinematic, and I thought that Brian Hitch is kind of the best at doing like a really cinematic comic book style. So in terms of the way he frames things, in terms of just sort of his epic splash pages, his landscapes, all that was really, really important for the look and feel of the story, I guess.
Yeah, that's really cool. Like pretty much everything you said right there, I can definitely see where all it's coming from, and I don't really think that there's very many books you could go and see like spaghetti western mixed with like you said earlier, he is very influenced by Italy, and you could definitely see that with the landscapes and all of the different buildings and stuff. It's really cool.
Yeah, actually so Port Prince is the first city that you see in that first issue, the first couple of pages. That's actually based on a Italian Renaissance city called San Gimignano, and you can go visit this place, and they have these massive towers that are just there, and it's basically a like for like kind of make of that. So Vince, you know, he spent a lot of time over there, and so he's like, yeah, this is what this place looks like. And same thing with Monterey, the capital city. He's like, this is a combination of Rome and Assisi. Vince is really the way I like to describe our partnership is Vince is very really, really strong and very visually oriented and very detail oriented as well. And I am more sort of like kind of a story guy, and also I'm more kind of big picture. So we kind of balance each other out that way as well.
Yeah, that's really cool. You kind of led me into my next question. And since you are more about the big picture and the story and stuff, have you do you come up with the names yourself mostly for like the ships and the characters, or is it like a collaboration thing? And did you get those from someplace, like any special influences for that?
Yeah, it's actually Vince is going to hate this answer, but yeah, we come up with the names together, or, you know, everybody kind of brings different names to the table. But I would say like a lot of the naming inventions are kind of like my little pet things. So Jameson Brown, the airship that gets exploded in the first issue and on page five or so, that's actually a coffee shop I go to a lot here in Pasadena called Jameson Brown, and I wrote a lot of Skies of Fire there, so I was like, I'm gonna blow this place up as well. And similarly, the Zephyr, which is the main ship that they go on, so I mean, Zephyr means one of the four winds, so it, you know, it's kind of fitting for an airship. But also there is another coffee/hookah shop also in Pasadena called Zephyr that I also go to a lot. So I was like, yeah. So if it's Jameson Brown over there, it's Zephyr. So I have this kind of coffee shop naming convention for a lot of the airships. And I think one of them mentions in passing that they go to another one. But anyway, and then in terms of individual names with meanings, they're honestly they're just more like Easter eggs and fun little facts. Like we had Delmont named as Morgan at first, and we were like, that's just way too stereotypical, having like a pirate captain named Morgan. So we're like, we need a different name for this guy. And I was eating a banana one day, and I saw the sticker of Del Monte, and I was like, what about Delmont? And Vince was like, that's a great name, let's go with that. And I was like, all right, come on. So I always joke with them, like in the next series, like series two, we're gonna have a villain named like Chiquita or something. I'm just gonna name them all after banana companies. But yeah, just, you know, we're just trying to like, that's mostly it. There's not a lot of super in-depth like kind of symbolism behind them, the names when we name them. It's more just sort of like what sounds good, and also like little fun Easter eggs like that.
Yeah.
That's cool. It's cool because it'll always have a special meaning, and it'll take you back to that time when you were creating this world. So
that's really cool.
And you did kind of touch on this in, when Jaden asked you about other media you've drawn ideas from. You mentioned Brian Hitch. Are there other comic artists that you would say that you look to when you were kind of learning the medium that were a big influence? Any comic creators that maybe that even some that you solicited advice from?
Yeah, so our backgrounds in comic they're quite interesting. So I guess not interesting, but they're just different in terms of all the people behind the project. So I come from, you know, traditional, you know, I was a big comic book fan, kind of Western superhero comics, big DC guy, and then slowly got into Marvel roughly around sort of circa 2002, 2003 to 2008 or 9. And I had to stop because I was in college living in a dorm in New York and I just couldn't afford buying all the floppies and storing them anymore. So that's sort of my reference point in terms of when I was sort of the biggest comic book fan and the biggest comic book geek. So Grant Morrison for JLA, he was like, that's who got me into comics in the first place. I was at a public library and I was actually supposed to be volunteering, but I was being a dip. So instead of volunteering, I wandered over to the graphic novel section and just started reading JLA trades that they had. And, you know, it was Grant Morrison stuff. And I was like, this is amazing. Mark Waid for Kingdom Come is really big. And then Mark Millar and Bendis, they were all massive when I was like really into comics, basically. I mean, they're still massive now, but you know, it's funny because I kind of, that's my reference point, right? So when I sort of got out of comics, that first time around, Bendis was like the biggest name and everybody admired and adored Bendis, and Bendis was the shit. And then when I sort of started exploring comics again after, you know, started writing it myself, and I was like, all right, let's see what's out there, and let's see what the kind of state of the industry is. You know, all the people online kind of shit on Bendis, I noticed, and it's like, yeah, Bendis has his certain dialogue style, and he's kind of played out, and that's like almost the prevailing opinion of him now, where a lot of people will hate on him, and I'm just like, man, you know, you have like your time in the sun, and then the fans turn on you, basically, no matter what. But so that's sort of for me and my reference point. And yeah, for me, it was always sort of, it's always more about the story. And I really like sort of following like writers more than art. And for Vince, he grew up on a lot of, like Franco-Belgian comics. So, Hergé, Tintin was a big one, Asterisk, like kind of Jodorowsky and humanoids and all of that super creepy, crazy, French, like science fiction stuff. That's sort of, the comics, kind of comics world that he comes from, especially Tintin. Like he always talks about Tintin, a lot. And then Pablo, so Pablo kind of apprenticed or assisted for Marcelo Fusine and Eduardo Risso. So that's sort of his artistic lineage, kind of those massive Argentinian artists. And that those are the guys he'll always kind of point to as the most influential in terms of his own work. But I think, I think he sort of evolved into his own thing, really. And you know, he gets a lot of compliments, like people compare him to, like, I don't know, Mobius a lot. So I think that's super, super flattering, but I don't think it's not an unfair comparison to him. I think he's just that good.
All right. My next question is, so you two have created this incredibly rich, detailed world. And it couldn't possibly all be conveyed in a comic book story, especially if you're only able to put out, you know, an issue every 6 to 10 months or so. So is there any thought to maybe doing some backstory in kind of a novel form or some kind of prose, form?
Yeah. Not like a novel form directly. We've talked about maybe using other mediums, like Manny's question in terms of the individual stories of these characters. That's something we've talked about and are sort of exploring moving forward with. But also just, we talked about specifically maybe about doing a tabletop RPG book and letting our readers and fans tell stories of their own in their own world and sort of laying out a lot of the background information there. So that's something we're looking at doing. Vince wrote a little piece of interactive fiction too, sort of just a choose your own text adventure that he was just trying out. With that, but in terms of novels, man, like novel prose is really, really difficult. Like, I consider myself mostly a screenwriter and a visual medium writer. And I have written prose in the past, but it's just, it's a whole nother animal, you know, like, and, our guiding philosophy is if we can't do it really good, if we can't do it up to sort of our standards, then we shouldn't do it, you know, or we should collaborate with someone who can. So in terms of like a novel, like a traditional fantasy novel, that's something we haven't really discussed.
Yeah, that's a good philosophy. I definitely would agree with that. It's just that I love the world so much, I'm greedy. I want more of it, honestly. That's why I was curious. So we talked a little bit about the fan reception that first time out at New York Comic Con. How's the fan reception been overall now that you're well into it? You've put out 3 issues so far. The world is established. You know, you have your website. Has the fan reception been just as good as that first time out?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's honestly been one of the best things about our short sort of comic career so far. The most amazing feeling is when you see a fan that, and you've already seen him at multiple shows, and he's just coming by to say hello, or he's bringing a group of friends and is like, check these guys out, they make really awesome stuff. Or when a fan comes up and says, oh, you're here, I need issue 3 and I need a sign right now. And that's such a gratifying feeling to have fans, and it's just really crazy to us to see that. And I would say, yeah, the reception has been really good. It has been mostly positive so far. And, you know, we're just really trying hard to create more content and be able to pump out more issues and, you know, do other projects as well, so that we can keep giving fans something new. Because although that's the best feeling when fans come up and they say hello again, one of the worst feelings is going to like the same show and not having new content to show. That is always kind of just a bummer, you know, when you don't have anything new, no new issues or anything. That sucks. But when you do have stuff that's new and you're excited, you're releasing it, and they see the new stuff and they're reacting really well to it, that's one of the best feelings.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about one of your upcoming projects. You know, first of all, thanks for showing me the pitch and the preview stuff for this this new project that's coming up. I know there haven't been a lot of eyes on it yet, so I felt very privileged to be able to check it out. It looks really awesome. Why don't you tell our listeners what it's all about?
Yeah, so our next project that we're releasing is called Glow, and it's a coming-of-age story set in a world where magic was the catalyst for both Industrial Revolution and Nuclear Holocaust. So thousands of years ago, this ancient civilization managed to harness mana as sort of... They managed to harness mana as a technology by creating these massive towers. And think of these towers as Green Lantern batteries. So they built these kind of Green Lantern battery repositories of mana everywhere they went. And not only were they able to channel magic through it and use it as an energy source, but they were able to pump the mana or anima in our world into the environment and create a verdant paradise. And that's how they were able to conquer all the other nations and unite the world. So by offering paradise. So for a time, there was literally paradise on Earth, green, verdant, and wonderful. But then one day the towers fell and they all fell simultaneously. And when they fell, they spilled the anima that they were holding inside, poisoning the Earth and changing it forever. And the story of Glow takes place about 100 years after that cataclysmic event, and it follows a brother and a sister. Cassie, who's a sister, she's a huntress and she's trained with like a long rifle. So the technology in this world is all sort of magically based, but they understand it sort of primitively. So they have guns and they have golems. They have other forms of technology, but it's all magically based. And then her brother, Koken, he's kind of a tinkerer slash artificer, so he can sort of see the old technology and intuitively be able to kind of fix it, kind of like Forge of the X-Men, where he's able to repair stuff really easily and understands how it works. And it's that ability that sort of gets them in trouble in the first arc.
What's the biggest difference for fans of Skies of Fire, maybe some that have had eyes on your previous work? What's the biggest difference do you feel between that story and this new story that you're going to be telling?
Man, they're so different. Like in terms of aesthetic, Skies of Fire is maybe more like European influenced and sort of has that look of like a Euro book. And I guess Glow has more of a Eastern look to it, like a more Japanese manga feel to it. So that's a big difference right off the bat. In terms of the scale of the story. So we thought of GLOW as sort of in season. So the scale of the story is not quite as epic, but it's also a little bit longer. So the way the story arcs work, we figured them as more sort of compact, where we could tell sort of multiple stories as opposed to just one story, because Skies of Fire was adapted from a movie screenplay, right? So that's sort of our structural reference for that. Whereas GLOW is structured more kind of like a TV series. So what we're trying to do with this series is we want to be able to have these self-contained arcs within two to four issues, basically, to sort of have like these individual episodes in this world while sort of progressing to an overall story like you would a traditional 22-episode TV show, basically.
Okay, fair enough. And what about the creative team that you've assembled for this new project?
Completely different, completely new. They're a group of really, really talented artists. This time we had a really hard time finding the creative team actually and getting the project started. We thought that, you know, honestly, we got super lucky with Pablo and Brian and everyone else the first time, right? So we were kind of like, well, if it wasn't too hard the first time, it'll be the same thing. We'll just do the same process over again and we'll find new artists. But that's not sort of how it worked out. A lot of people had trouble getting the look that we were looking for, right? Like, you know, because it's kind of a weird hodgepodge of genres. Like, it has this manga look to it, but then it's like a little bit dystopian, but it's also like kind of, I call it like techno fantasy, where it's got, you know, like golems and just sort of that almost like a video gamey quality to it that I really wanted. So it was really hard finding someone that was able to do that, or the people that we thought would be able to do it really well. They were all super famous and didn't answer our emails, basically. So for this one, I ended up going to a local art school, Art Center Pasadena, and I put up job wanted posters, basically. Same thing, kind of like, this is our page rate, this is what we're looking for, send your portfolio for more details. And I was able to luckily find a really talented young artist named Dia Zha, who's actually only 20 years old. She's a sophomore in art school. And we saw her portfolio. She didn't have any sequential stuff in there, but her stuff looked really cool. And she was kind of working in the same wheelhouse that we had envisioned too. So we're like, okay, look, I think we can work with her, and I think we can kind of develop the look and feel. So over the course of last year around this time, we were working really closely with her to do character designs, just figure out the look of this world. And then I knew that the style we wanted was kind of East meets West, with sort of a little bit more of a tilt on East, but maybe with Western framing conventions, where it's a little bit more detailed oriented. And I knew through Brian, our colorist for Skies of Fire, that Indonesia's got a really crazy art scene, where they, you know, they're in Southeast Asia. They have like Japan right there. So they're obviously influenced by sort of the manga look, but they actually read a lot of Western superhero comics. They're really into DC. They're really into Marvel, really into Image. They're really into sort of all of the American comics out there. So you'll see their sketches and they'll be drawing Superman and Batman, but doing it in sort of this natural fusion style where it kind of looks like an anime, but it really isn't. So I knew like, if we found like an Indonesian artist, they would sort of be working in that wheelhouse too. So once we had the initial look, I sent Brian an email and I was like, Brian, you know anybody who like would like to work in this style? And I sent them a couple of Diaz concepts, and he was like, you know what? Actually, I have one of my friends, Annie Molina. She would love this stuff. So she introduced us, or he introduced us to her, and she started working for us as well. And then, from all the other artists, we basically found all the other artists. And what's kind of interesting is that the entire art team is female. They're all girls. Like, there's not a single guy on the art team. Well, I guess Nick on letters, but that's pretty much it. And that just sort of happened naturally too. It just kind of referrals, and like Dia would be like, oh, there's this one girl that I think is really cool and she could do some character designs. So we would hit her up and she would do character designs for us. So it kind of just fell into place that way.
Well, that's really cool. Where's the book at in development right now? Like, how close are you to being able to release the first issue?
We are currently done with 11 out of the 24 pages. And we need finishing funds, though. We don't have enough money to do the rest of the pages. So this project has been, I guess, gesticulating for the better part of like 3 to 4 years now. So we've worked on this project almost as long as Skies of Fire. But because it took such a long time to get the art team in place, you know, we had some other challenges. And some things from a business standpoint that we kind of had to do was we actually wanted to launch this Kickstarter back in November, right after NYCC, but we didn't have a lot of the rewards that we wanted to offer in place. So we decided to push it back to the new year. And right around the new year, it became kind of obvious that we were going to finish issue 3 of Skies of Fire. So we had this weird position at the turn of the year. We were like, okay, both of these projects are sort of good to go, but we can't really run 2 Kickstarters simultaneously. And if that's our business model, what do we do? So we had to basically decide to do Skies of Fire first. So the GLOW team has sort of just been on hold and on standby until all of this stuff is done. Until, because, you know, it's... making comic books is not cheap, and we need revenue too. We need money to do this stuff and pay all of our artists. So, at a certain point, we're like, all right, we need to get in some money so we can keep working on stuff, basically. So, 11 out of the 25 pages done or so. The art team is completely in place. Everyone's freed up schedule in the summer to bang it out. We want to do the Kickstarter next month, basically through May, and then be able to finish the book maybe in August, and hopefully release it in September and go to NYCC with it as well.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to it just from seeing the pages that I was able to preview. Yeah, the art, I read the overall pitch first, you know, and establishing the world and talking about the characters. You know, I didn't go down through the document you sent me and look at the visuals first. I just, you know, took it as it came, and yeah. It wasn't what I was expecting, but it really blew me away, especially the detail in the background, and like you said, that real fusion, you know, the characters, you can definitely see the anime feel, in the visualization of the characters, but yeah, definitely a Western style in the backgrounds, and it made for a very interesting viewing, so, yeah, really, really cool. And one of the things I kind of, as I was reading through the pitch, some of the themes of the story kind of came to me. It seemed like some of the things you wanted to explore were like being able to trust the people that are supposedly in authority over you, and trust your family, and as you grow as a person, because these main characters you talked about are young. And so it's about finding your identity and having self-confidence in yourself and your abilities. Would you say that those are themes that are going to be explored in the story?
Oh, yeah, definitely. For me personally, as a writer, you know how writers always say, like, they're always attracted to certain themes for whatever reason. Like, that's sort of like what they enjoy exploring a lot of times. And I feel like a big one for me is, like, yeah, this whole... trust thing and relationships and sort of like betraying relationships and like, what does it mean to like gain someone's trust, to lose someone's trust? That's something I find myself, sort of drawn to a lot of times. But yeah, that's definitely a big one. And also, yeah, like you said, it is a coming of age story, and we wanted these characters to really grow as the story progressed. And hopefully we'll get to a point where, the people they end up at the end of the story is completely different from the people they were at the beginning. And, you know, we really want to push those aspects and hopefully give it a really, like, a good heart to the story, basically.
Now, Jaden, you had a chance to look over the stuff as well. What are your thoughts about GLOW?
Well, I looked over pretty briefly, but, I mean, the art is amazing. I would pick up this book just to see the art. And, I mean, it looks, from what I've seen of it in this small pitch that you sent to me, it's really cool. I mean, I'm really looking forward to it just for the, like, just the art. And I mean, I've loved Skies of Fire for the 3 issues that I've read, so I'm assuming this is going to be just as good and or better.
Manny, you have some thoughts?
Yeah, just like Jaden, I really like the artwork. I like kind of the anime feel it has, and just the fact that how it's all set up kind of by a misunderstanding, and Skies of Fire so far has been great, and the whole idea of the the way magic works in this land, I think was great also. I'd want to learn, read more about that, learn more about that, be a little bit more involved in that world. So, yeah, it looks really interesting, and I can't wait to read the first issue.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
So, Ray, why don't you tell our listeners if they want to contribute? You currently have a Kickstarter running right now, correct?
Yeah, so we're kickstarting currently for the print run of issue number 3, which I had, you know, like an advanced copy print run at WonderCon that I think you picked up. And if they're interested, they can go to www.skiesofire.com. And it's not just a Kickstarter for the current issue as well. So our model always is to release the... If we reach our last stretch goal for the last campaign, what we promise to our backers is we'll give them the digital copy of our next issue for free, because the last stretch goal is to fund the production of the next issue. So it's only fair that they get it for free. So we'll release it basically a day before the Kickstarter, and then we'll let them know, like, okay, if you want to get a print copy of the Kickstarter, for the first 72 hours, it's only $7 plus shipping to get it. And, you know, and we also kind of mentioned, like, that's sort of how the best way to support us, because Kickstarter typically allows us the funds to continue the story and do the next issue. And so that's sort of been our publishing model so far. So, I mean, without Kickstarter, without crowdfunding, we wouldn't be anywhere, basically. Like, it's given us all the opportunity in the world to do this stuff. So if it sounds cool, if Skies of Fire sounds cool, all you have to do is go to www.skiesofire1f.com, skiesofire.com, and it'll redirect you straight to our Kickstarter.
Cool. And then, like you said, the next Kickstarter campaign will be for Glow. Is that right?
Yeah. So we're going to do back-to-back campaigns, basically. So once the Skies of Fire issue 3 Kickstarter wraps, maybe a week after that, we're not too sure on the exact details yet, but pretty much in the month of May is when we're planning to run it, and just hopefully be able to get the funds to complete the issue and do a print run.
Cool. And if somebody wants to go pick up the issues themselves in person, see you at a show, meet you, talk about the project, what's your convention schedule like coming up?
Yeah, so I'll be at Emerald City Comic Con from this upcoming Thursday through Sunday. So that'll be pretty cool. First time going to ECCC, so that'll be neat. And then I think the only convention that we have scheduled, that I have scheduled, is San Diego in July. I don't think I'm doing anything between that. And then we'll all be at San Diego. Me and Vince will be at San Diego, and then we'll also be at NYCC in October. And I think I might do Salt Lake Comic Con again too. I did it last year because I have family out there, so it's nice to just sort of visit and also do a show at the same time. And then as far as Vince goes, I think he's going to MCM Scotland again, MCN, and then maybe MCM London. I don't know if he's confirmed for that, but Bubble, and that's sort of his upcoming con schedule for the UK.
Cool. And if our listeners, is there any other places on social media where maybe they can get information, follow along, and keep up to date with what's going on?
Yeah, they. So we have a Twitter. We also have Instagram. It's the same handle, at SkiesOfFire1F, and our Facebook is facebook.com/SkiesOfFire, also with 1F.
Cool. Well, you know, listeners, I hope you take advantage of this. Go to the websites, check out the books. Certainly, if you're going to be at San Diego, I encourage you to go up and meet Ray and check out the books. I'm glad to hear you're going to be at San Diego, because Jaden and I are both going to be there, and it'll be good to see you. You'll be able to meet Jaden face to face. We'll be able to talk a little bit more. Looking forward to that for sure.
So, yeah, definitely.
So thanks for joining us, Ray. Any last thoughts or anything you want to share with our listeners before we sign off here?
No, just thanks again for having me. I mean, this was awesome. I loved being on the show.
Yeah, hey man, this was a great show. I learned a lot. I feel like you know, the book is great, and it's rich and it's detailed, and learning some of the backstory just made me appreciate what you've done and appreciate the story even more. So I hope a lot of our listeners take advantage and go pick up the book. Now, they can also order the previously published, right? And not just 3 at your website. They can get the previous published books shipped to them as well, correct?
Yeah. And they can also do it through the Kickstarter as well. And hopefully we're reprinting books one and two along with this Kickstarter, and hopefully we'll have enough where I'll be able to sort of expand our retail presence too, because we're basically not on any sort of direct market comic book stores at all, but you know, trying to change that.
Okay, great. Well, once again, I want to thank you listeners for joining us on the Comic Source podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. If you want to follow along with us, keep up to date with what's going on, you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. You can reach out, contact us directly through email. The email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com. Of course, you can go to our website, thecomicsourceblog.com. All our previous episodes of our podcast are there. You can read my written blog there, Manny's written blog. Check out the sketch gallery. You can see episodes of our YouTube channel. Pretty much a source for all things Comic Source. We're also on Facebook. Just do a search for The Comic Source. That's us. We're on Instagram. And we really appreciate, we're trying to grow The Comic Source as a brand so that we can have more access to publishers, cover more conventions, maybe get some exclusives from publishers at some point in the future. So any traffic we have on our site, any following we have on social media really helps us out. iTunes reviews, if that's how you download our episodes, 5-star reviews help out immensely. So we appreciate all the support. I want to thank Ray once again, and we'll talk to you next time, guys. Take care.